we're following a standard form, and I'm inviting you to be attentive to it now so that you can recognize that there's something very peculiar going on here in this structure. If you actually look at this page and you look at the text structure, you notice that the very beginning here in the movement has three texts, but that the initial one, Thoreau, was not a part of the structure, but I use the term glue. He's like a glue. It's like when you're mathematically writing a fraction. If you write one half, what have you written? You've written three things. You've written the one, and you've written the two, but you've also written a line in between the two of them. What is that line? That line symbolically indicates a relationship. That horizontal line, that fraction line indicating a relationship, is what Thoreau represents here in this structure. And it's not until we get to the stand that we realize that now we bring Thoreau back into the picture, and that Thoreau and the double helix form a kind of a complement together. What kind of a complement? They seal that synthesizing idea. They seal that world axis that establishes a world of possibility, so that there will be a relationship between Thoreau and what we did with Thoreau and the double helix, the book of the discovery of DNA. What is DNA? The structure of life. So if there's a relationship between what we read in Thoreau and the structure of life, there'll be the relationship between the observer, the archetypal observer, and the structure which can be observed. So that if you want to draw yourself a little diagram in your mind, the I Ching and origins begin to move away from the plateau, begin to establish a world, to begin to establish a deeper dimension of nature. And galaxies in the Tao of Physics carry this further, so that we have these four books, and in a way, it's like a staged process. The line goes, the sphere is established maybe this far, and then we shift to galaxies and the Tao of Physics, and it goes that far, and then we bring in Thoreau and the double helix, and it establishes the line in between. So that we have a structure which we have actually made through our doing. It takes us 3 months to do this, which I must tell you is like jet speed. To do this in 3 months, I mean, there were whole ages where you would have had to be a super yogi in order to just do this. Five thousand years ago, if somebody could have done this, they would have been named Pythagoras. Because it was just almost impossible to do this right. And the first time that there are human beings who are able to do this right is the first time that you have such a thing as cosmology. And before 600 BC, there's not much cosmology anywhere in the world. There's a lot of mythology, but there's not much cosmology. And as soon as this happens, the mythological interest of human beings begins to atrophy, and the cosmological interest in human beings begins to rise. And it's like mythology goes off the hip charts and cosmology comes on. All the cosmology groups hit it big. All the mythological groups begin to have low sales. It's like that. Notice that what has happened is that there is an interiorization of meaning to the point of comprehension. Now, human beings were hard-pressed to be conscious of what it was that they understood, but they had the experience that they, in fact, had understood something fundamental. That they had had the experience of a synthesizing idea. That they felt confident that somehow a new order had been established and that they were a part of it. That their capacities were a key part of this new world order, whatever it was. And it's in the 3rd century B.C. that you find this kind of a tone everywhere in the world. You begin to find this kind of tone that we have got somewhere that's new, but we're not quite sure what it is, but we know that we have got there and that by what we have done has this new world been made, this new dimension. The great symbol that I use for this is the establishment of the city of Alexandria. Everywhere in the world before, wherever there are great cities, those cities are great because they are the culmination of an ethnic tradition. If there's an Anyang in China, it's because of the Shang dynasty in China. If there's an Athens in Greece, it's because of the Attic Greeks. If there's a Rome, it's because of the Italian. Alexandria is the first cosmopolitan city in the world. It's the first time that there's a city for a cosmology. And it's established about 325 B.C. So I use Alexandria, and it's come to be a pretty universal symbol by now. Alexandria is a symbol of this synthesizing idea becoming conscious. Look what we can do. We can have a city which expresses the culture of all mankind. The Greek word for that was the ecumenikos. When Alexander the Great's Greek generals asked him why he wanted them to marry Persian women, he said, "We are no longer Greeks. We are human beings in the ecumenikos. And our children have to not be Greek, but they have to be examples of all mankind. We have to belong to a single world." That was about 330 B.C. So you can see that the synthesizing idea of a cosmology had risen to just the fringes of consciousness about that time. So that this synthesizing idea some 2,300 years ago was brand new. Brand new. And almost all of history since then has been a playing out of this synthesizing idea expressing itself until, in our time, we have the definite capacity and facility and understanding now on every street level in any city in the world that there is such a thing as a mankind and that there is such a thing as a home planet. At one time, 2,300 years ago, this would have been almost inconceivable. In fact, when Alexander died, every one of his Greek generals divorced his Persian wife except one. Several hundred. Because it just couldn't take. It was 2,000 years in advance of what was possible. Let's take a break now, and we'll come back. great length because I know it's difficult to draw. Let's go back to the I Ching just for a moment. And let's pull a central element out of the I Ching. It occurs on page 299 of the Wilhelm Dane's translation of the I Ching.
Page what?
299. About the middle of the page, it's in the Ta Chuan, the great treatise. Ta means big in Chinese. So it's the big treatise, the long commentary. The Ta Wing, big wing. And it reads here, the movement from within outward shows Tao in its manifestations as the force of supreme kindness. And that's it. That's all we need. We just need that sentence. When the movement is from within outward, that's a manifestation. The characteristic tone of that manifestation is loving kindness. In other words, whenever there is a movement from inside out, its real tone is loving kindness. Now here's something that wasn't available at the time of the I Ching. What moves from the inside out is consciousness. Nature does not move in that way. Nature moves from the outside in. It's the nature of nature to interiorize. When we say that someone is au naturel, we mean that they're permeable to nature coming in to themselves. And that the complement to that is when you express from the inside out, then that's consciousness. Now notice that loving kindness is not an integration mode occurrence at all, but is a differentiation mode occurrence. And that while integration modes are largely feeling toned, differentiation modes are largely thinking toned. So that loving kindness is an act of thought and not an act of feeling. Or to put it another way, compassion is a characteristic of thought and not a characteristic of feeling. This is why the bodhisattva has to be conscious, because the bodhisattva cannot exist without consciousness. To just feel loving kindness is not it at all. To have loving kindness characterize your consciousness is the whole show in terms of a bodhisattva, a helper being. The Tao, moving from inside out, comes from the center outward. Where is that center? What is that center? That center, since we were talking about it this morning, occurs because of what we have done, and that the shape of what we have done has left an opening to allow the self to express its conscious loving kindness. Now, this is not an altruistic notion at all. This is just structural realism. It's not. There's nothing sentimental in what I'm saying right now at all. And incidentally, nothing romantic, necessarily. Although it's of the highest romance. It's what Alfred North Whitehead used to call an adventure in learning. What we're doing now in the nature section is we're laying the groundwork. In fact, we're doing the groundwork by cutting out a space wherein we can lay the foundation. And when we build on that foundation, the structure that we will build will be a home, a psychic home that we can actually live in, a home that a human being could inhabit. Not some kind of speculatively abstract box which would collect us like something, but as Frank Lloyd Wright said, a home where a human being could function in whatever ways they considered appropriate. And that's a whole different thing. In expanding our world, the teaming together of physics and astronomy to make a cosmological synthesizing idea has been a hallmark of man now for some time. And the earliest attempts at this come around 3,000-4,000 years ago. For instance, let's use an example. Stonehenge in the Wiltshire Plain, Salisbury Plain, dates from about 2800 BC. And through the work of people like Alexander Thom and Gerald Hawkins, we pretty well come to understand that it's a megalithic observatory meant to keep track of the sun and the moon and several prominent stars, to not just allow man to experience the seasons at ground level, but to conceive of the seasonal cycle as a universal occurrence. It's a whole different orientation. It shows a cosmological interest. What was the physics of that time? The physics of that time was wrapped up in metallurgy. Megalithic physics had to do with metallurgy, the working with metals, so that the complement to the stargazer was the blacksmith. And often the blacksmith was a magician, just like the stargazer was a magician. And the origins of astrology come from the stargazer, and the origins of alchemy come from the blacksmith. So how does alchemy and astrology come to characterize the Hermetic sciences? Because of the way in which it occurred in human experience. And because they were related from the beginning in that experience and matured simultaneously as a synthesizing idea. Now, once you have a grasp like this, once you have this kind of power of conception, it's like you begin to joggle the image base in your mind. It's like 25 years ago, the old-fashioned way that computers used to work with the cards, you used to have to put all the cards in a joggler to get the cards straight before you could feed them into the machines and get the direction. This is like a joggler, getting the images arranged in the natural way in which they occurred in human experience. Now, one of the qualities that we have come to understand about evolution is that the individual development follows the group development. Every human embryo goes through stages which actually occurred for levels of species before that. We, as individuals, go through that kind of morphology, that morphological transformation. And because if we have gone through it all to the last working stage of the sequence, we have the right then to make the next sequence on our own, the next stage on our own. We have the right then, having gone through the whole ecology up to that point, that whatever we do next is not only free, it's not only up to us to do it, but when it's done with that kind of comprehension, it enters into the sequence. It adds to the dimensions that man is capable of. So that once one human being has taken one step, it is available in the genome for anyone else. Now, this is not only 1990 genetics, microbiological genetics, it's also 1990 BC Egyptian religious conviction. Ra's journey each day adds that comprehensive little cube of possibility to the aggregate of all the cubes of possibility that he has already done by his journeying. And so every day Ra adds a new day to the continuity of reality and extends it one more day each day. So that out of nothingness, Ra's journeying carves the eternal now, each day adding to it. And that a human being who is in the train of Ra may do this also and achieve immortality, because the god is immortal, will always the next day add that day. So that the living movement of the continuity of eternal time extends into the unknown. Now, this is Egyptian mysticism. If you look for the synthesizing idea in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Book of Coming Forth by Day, this is the synthesizing idea. It also has its complement in 1990 genetics. What's important to us, though, is to understand that we do not have any freedom whatsoever until we have matured to the point of fullness, and then we have 100% freedom, wide open freedom. But we have to earn it by, as Plato says in the Symposium, we have to earn it by going up the ladder of ascent, rung by rung, step by step, stage by stage. And wherever the top of that ladder is, wherever it is, that's the threshold of the entrance into the divine. And man has the privilege and the responsibility that when he is matured to the point at the threshold of the divine, he joins divinity in taking a creative next step. he has the freedom, the privilege, and the responsibility to do that. And when he does, that becomes real. Having done that, that is done and available and part of what is there. Now, this is timeless wisdom, but presented in a more contemporary fashion, comparative contemporary fashion. Now, with the Tao of physics, let's come to our material. I'm going to go to the Tao of physics and galaxies next week. I'm going to start right away. So you should, if you can, review your notes or review the tape or review your thoughts about today's lecture. And next week I'll start right off with it because it'll be the eighth week. In other words, I'm going to go to galaxies and the Tao of physics next week and treat them in such a way that the very following week, the ninth week, I can go directly to the double helix and Thoreau. So that next week and the following week, I want to establish a 1-2 sequence. I want to establish for you that, look, last week we set up the situation saying that there is such a thing as a sequence. All right? If there is such a thing as a sequence, let's be very Pythagorean about it. Show us. The Pythagorean tone is, don't just speculate, demonstrate it. If it is the case, we have a right to determine that ourselves. So it's like presenting evidence before a jury. And as the prosecuting attorney, attorney. There's a Jungian slip for you. As a prosecuting eternity against ignorance, I want to present the case so that you can come to the right conclusion and condemn ignorance to oblivion, which is where it belongs. Ignorance is happy in oblivion. Right? You're not sentencing something nice to something bad. Ignorance belongs in oblivion. That's its proper home. So next week, I want to present the first batch of evidence of saying, okay, we've talked about it, here's this, and then the following week showing how it links together. Or the way I used to use, I taught in Western Canada for a long time, I used the term cinch. There's a time when you have to be able to cinch an idea into your conceptual context. It's like getting the saddle on the horse, but the last step is to cinch it. Make sure it's going to stay on the horse, because you want to be able to ride. That's why you're putting the saddle on the horse. Not just to do that, but because you want to use it then. So in 2 weeks, I want to be able to cinch this idea. What is the idea? The idea is that there are such things as synthesizing ideas that hold together world views. And that they occur as early as primitive man's experience with nature. But that primitive man had no way to make them conscious to himself because he was busy integrating. So where did it register? It didn't register in consciousness. It did not register in thought. It registered in an invisible sense of presence for primitive man. And even though he couldn't see it, he knew that it was there. Because deep in the caves, around the mystic fires, he could confide with other persons who knew that it was there, and they came to see, that's right. Every time any one of us gets to this kind of a level of comprehension, we feel that God is here. And we can't all be wrong all the time. All of us could be wrong some of the time. Some of us could be wrong all the time, but not all of us. That was a caveman named Abraham Lincoln who came up with that. But not all of us can be wrong all of the time. Therefore, we have to trust that. That even though we can't put our finger on it, we can't really express it, we know that it's there, and thus the whole sense that God is present present becomes very, very, very strong conviction for primitive man. When that happens, the species changes. It's no longer Homo Neanderthal, it's Homo sapiens, named for wisdom man. What is he wise about? He's wise to the presence of the divine. That in some ineffable way, the divine is present right there where he is. Now, this is a very primordial quality which any human being since then can come to experience. Usually for us, because there are so many layers, we have to get into a life-threatening terminal situation before we can experience it. The British expedition led by Commander Scott to the South Pole, where all of the members their tractors didn't work and they didn't have sled dogs like the Norwegians, and they ended up having to pull the sledges themselves, and they all perished. They all died. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until the next year that rescue expeditions found them all frozen to death. And all of them had kept diaries, and in every single diary towards the end were statements about that they kept looking to their side because they felt there was someone else there with them. All of them felt that because of the reality of the presence of the divine in the human psyche. In one of John Muir's writings, I think it's in the mountains of California, the first time that he was at Yosemite and was just awestruck by the valley and was up on top of El Capitan and was inching his way down, and he was awestruck, and he watched the sunset, and then it began to get dark, and he turned to go back up, and he realized that he'd come way down the face, and he was trying to get back up, and he got trapped, because he realized that it got fatigued, his muscles had gotten fatigued, it was getting dark, and suddenly it occurred to him that that was it. There was no way to get back, and no way to stay there. And he records, he says he looked at the rock before him and an unearthly calm settled on him. And without any effort at all, he just walked back up to the top. And it's like that. Your own shadow becomes like a mystic prow in a phantom world and just moves on. And it's uncanny. It's that primordial level of the presence of the divine that is there. Jung carved over his doorway, called or not, God will be there. More next week.